Moss and Barnett is pleased to present the Debt Collection Drill, the podcast featuring Moss and Barnett shareholders John Rossman and Mike Ponson, providing sage tips for improving collections and compliance.
Welcome again, everybody, to another edition of the Debt Collection Drill. I'm Mike Ponson, and with me is John Rossman, chair of our Creditors Remedies Practice Group here at Moss and Barnett.
Thanks, Mike. It's been a while since we've done a podcast together. I know we've had an opportunity for our listeners to hear from some other voices in our office. We've had podcasts featuring Jim Bedell, attorney from our office, attorney Sarah Dorr, and attorney Issa Moe this year. I think we'll put up links to those three podcasts. I know we've gotten some great feedback to those. Mike, you and I have been pretty busy. I know you've been in Washington, D.C. recently. Could you briefly share with our listeners what your experiences were in D.C.?
Yes, it was the Inside Arm Large Market Participant Summit. It was a very interesting conference. I presented on current trends in consumer litigation. It was nice how they broke it into small groups. And the other really nice feature, though, was that they had members from the CFPB there, different sections within the CFPB. And they would have about 25 of us sit down and meet with anywhere from 4 to 6 of them in a kind of a round table type discussion format, ask questions. And, you know, the CFPB was forthcoming when they could be. And obviously there were at times when they were unable to answer. But it was nice to get a breakdown of how things are working and what they're striving towards and striving toward having some their rules in place by the end of the year. You know, whether that happens or not, we'll see. But they, I know they received a ton of comments, and they do go through all of those. So it was interesting to see how they work on it. But, you know, right now there's still a lot of unanswered questions for the collection industry, that's for sure.
You know, the feedback I got from the conference, and unfortunately I was unable to attend, the feedback that I got was that meeting, those sets of meetings with the CFPB where agency owners and executives and folks like Mike could meet directly at the CFPB was the best session that anyone has had with regulators in terms of that type of access and that type of questions, that kind of interaction that you had with the regulators. Mike, I know about 4 years ago, it was actually March 2012, so I guess it's about 3 years ago, we did a podcast called The Most Treacherous Place for Debt Collectors in the USA. And one place that we focused on during that podcast was West Virginia. And there have been some recent changes to the West Virginia law. I know those changes go into effect in June 2015, and I wanted to focus today on those changes. Mike, I know you and I have talked briefly about those changes to the law. What was your initial take on the changes, the upcoming changes to the West Virginia law?
Initially, well, I thought this has to be upsetting a handful of consumer attorneys out there. But, you know, the one thing that jumps to my mind is what I see in every lawsuit in West Virginia is the claim that there were communications after the consumer provided notice that they were represented by counsel. And most of the time, those claims could not be substantiated. There was no truth to them, and we have been able to prove as such. But they made a change here, specifically providing that notice of attorney representation now has to be provided in writing. And that notice must clearly state the attorney's name, address, telephone number, and it has to be sent to the debt collector's registered agent identified in the identified by the debt collector at the office of the West Virginia Secretary of State, and if not there, at the debt collector's principal place of business. And the other kicker to this was that you have 72 hours to comply with this notice of attorney representation. So if you receive the letter and it doesn't instantly go into your notes and you make another call, you, from reading this, you will not be on the hook for those first communications within 72 hours. So it should limit those claims based on contact after a consumer retains counsel.
You know, it's a great insight that you have regarding that law and how it's going to apply. As you know, I was in West Virginia last year, and I testified before a legislative subcommittee on this specific law and on proposed changes to this law. And when the questions came up regarding this section of the law, what I stated to the legislators was, in every other jurisdiction, every other state, when an attorney is retained by a client, the first thing the attorney does is send a letter of representation to the opposing party. It just makes sense. You're an attorney. You get a signed retainer agreement. What's the first thing you do? You send a letter to the other side saying, hello, I've been retained by this person to represent them. Please direct all further communication to me. Unfortunately, what was happening in West Virginia and what spurred the changes in the law is those letters weren't going out from the attorneys. Rather, it was the consumers and the burden being put on the consumers to communicate to debt collectors that they are represented by counsel. And that resulted in, a lot of instances, inconsistent communications as to what type of information, how it was communicated. And so this law and this change to the law makes it crystal clear that for claims of attorney representation in West Virginia, there must be a written notice to the debt collector. And yeah, Mike, I know we've seen a lot of cases, and we've defended a number of cases in West Virginia where the issue came down to there was some type of verbal notice of attorney representation from the consumer, and then there were calls made after that for reasons probably because the notice was inadequate or unclear. Calls would go on for some period of time without any answer, and then a lawsuit would pop up seeking hundreds of thousands of dollars or more in damages. So this change to the law, in my mind, first of all, brings West Virginia law into line with both the laws in other states, but also into line with common sense as far as what should happen with respect to attorney-client representation. Mike, I know we've talked and we've defended cases on the issue of call volume in West Virginia, and there were some changes to the call volume statements in the statute. Could you speak to those?
Yeah, and it's actually, that's a question you get a lot. How many times can I call somebody? And, you know, looking at the case law over the years, finding that, 132 calls over 6 months is acceptable,
That's a case that you won, by the way, yes.
Correct. And looking at the new law, it limits calls to 30 times per week or 10 telephone conversations per week. So, I mean, right there you're looking at it will not be a presumed violation if you make 120 phone calls over a 28-day period, which to me is, kind of remarkable. It definitely provides for a lot of phone calls, and I would imagine this is also upsetting to folks on the consumer side.
I mean, there's a reasonableness element to this as far as the reason for the number of calls per week. Keep in mind it talks about calls per week, and then it talks about engaging in telephone conversation 10 times per week. So the calls can be made, like we saw previously with those West Virginia lawsuits, a call would be made, the person would never answer the call, no message would be left, but yet the claim would be you, the debt collector, are liable for $4,900 in statutory penalties for each call, whether or not it was even answered or whether any message was left. So really what this does is clarify the situation. I do like the way that is clarified in terms of the volume of calls, but keep in mind at the same time there's also that this is just a presumption. And certainly, as with any law and as with the FDCPA, if you call up someone and they say, stop calling me, or they say, I'm not going to pay, you need to think about, what the intent of the calls is after that. And that's certainly, this is one factor and this is a presumption, but this is not the be-all and the end-all. These are simply guidelines that are set forth by the West Virginia legislature.
And one last thing I'll add to that, one thing that I do like, we've all heard least sophisticated consumer standard, unsophisticated consumer standard. When it comes to call volume, and maybe John, you can advise if there's other areas in the law, but here it sets forth that it's to be the collector's conduct will be evaluated from the standpoint of a reasonable person. And I know those in the collection industry will be relieved to see that there's actually a reasonable person standard.
It's a fascinating interpretation of the law. It's a fascinating law. A lot of times we never know what we're going to get when we talk about the least sophisticated consumer. I know there was that judge in the Seventh Circuit that talked about the least sophisticated consumer as the person who is one step below the lowest rung of sophistication. Great visual, but really don't know exactly what that means. Certainly as lawyers, when we see the reasonable person standard, something you learn about in law school, something you learn about in torts, there's a very specific definition that goes in with a reasonable person standard. Here again, I think it's a really good change to the law from the standpoint that it will provide protection for the consumers, but it will also provide some very clear guidelines for the debt collectors. Mike, I know one of the most frustrating components to West Virginia law prior to these changes was the issue of damages. And prior to this, damages were set at a certain amount per violation, and that amount was interpreted by some courts using the inflationary tables to come out to, I believe, is $4,900 or $5,000 per violation. And so if you had a situation where you had some type of vague notice of attorney representation and then you made calls, you didn't leave a message, or you didn't otherwise communicate with the consumer. Let's say he made 100 calls. The claim would come in for $500,000, saying, well, you made 100 calls after attorney representation, even though that notice was vague. You dialed the number 100 times. 100 times 5,000, it's $500,000. There's been some changes to that. Mike, I know you and I talked about that a little bit before we went on the air here. What were your thoughts to the changes that were made regarding the damages provision under the West Virginia Consumer Credit Protection Act?
Well, you know, and I know we may disagree to some extent. I know the inflation thing was something that always got folks riled up when you were looking at up to $4,800 per violation. You know, most courts didn't quite apply it to that extent. But, you know, it doesn't seem to completely fix the issue. It seems to leave some ambiguity and some question how it's going to be applied. But it's not as favorable as the FDCPA as I look at it when you're looking at $1,000 per violation. So no, I wish it would have gone further.
No, I agree. It didn't go as far as the FDCPA. As you and I both know, there have been calls from consumer groups that the FDCPA damages amount should be changed. As it stands right now in West Virginia, it's $1,000 per violation. There's a cap, but that cap is either the amount of the debt or $175,000, whichever is greater. There is an inflation element to it. Here again, as you know with legislation, it's oftentimes negotiated both with legislators as well as with other interested groups, and I know this is one provision that was negotiated.
I was just going to ask one final question here, as I know we're coming up on our time, but a question you might get, is this going to apply proactively? Will it apply to a pending litigation? If somebody received a letter or was told that somebody had an attorney, you know, 2 months ago and they get sued on that, can they then argue that, well, it wasn't in writing? What's your take on that?
Sure. I don't see any retroactive provision in this statute. For instance, I know we litigated and won recently in the Seventh Circuit. I'm sorry, in the Sixth Circuit, the Bradford case. And the Bradford case dealt with the Tennessee licensing statute. And that had a specific retroactive effect. Specifically, that statute stated, you know, this statute clarifies the laws that existed previously. We don't see that type of provision here in the West Virginia statute. I think the argument can be made. And I'm sure at some point the argument will be made, but certainly this statute does not have the same type of provision that we've seen in other state laws where it was seeking to clarify or be retroactive. Mike, we are out of time for today. Thank you again for another great episode. I'd also like to thank our executive producer, Jody Newsom, and we look forward to speaking with you next time. Thank you.
Visit the website for this podcast at thedebtcollectiondrill.com. And follow us on Twitter at @CollectDrill. This program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any listener. Please remember that we can only give general information and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns.